And one of the things we see over and over again that comes up in this book is the way that this imam in particular, and of course the imams before him, were received as spiritual authorities outside of the Ismaili community.
Daniel, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me, Sahil.
Congratulations on the release of your translation of the memoirs or autobiography of Imam Hasan Ali Shah. For those unaware, your book was completed in conjunction with Dr. Daryush Mohammadpour and published by the IIS. Imam Hasan Ali Shah, as we know, was the imam who migrated from Persia to the Indian subcontinent. To start, could you give us a couple of examples of what were for you the most surprising and unexpected or even heartwarming anecdotes you learned about the imam or the community at that time?
Sure. Well, perhaps first I could say a few things more generally about the book and why I think it's an interesting and important book for the Jamaat and more broadly for a general readership. Well, first of all, it is the first autobiographical account we have from a Nizari imam. We have, of course, from earlier imams, snippets of farmans, of various sayings and whatnot, but this is really the first book that we can say definitively came from the hand of a Nizari imam that really gives us a full account of his life and really gives us a deep sense of the everyday life of one of our imams. So it's a very important book for that reason as well. And more generally, I think it's an important book because it really speaks to something that has struck me as a very significant gap in what I would call the historical consciousness of our Jamaat, which is that we talk a lot about the Fatimid era, about the Alamut period, about a lot of famous scholars and authors who lived in this period. And then, after this, in the 13th century, we have the Mongol conquests, we have the destruction of the Ismaili headquarters at Alamut, the murder of Imam Rukhnuddin Khorr Shah. And then after that, of course, the history of the community moves into a very obscure, very dark period for a number of centuries.
Right.
And it's a period that still relatively little is known about. Some of the imams from this period, we know basically nothing more than their names. And that really changes, I think, for most of us with Imam Sultan Muhammad Shah. We often think of as the imam who really brought the community into public consciousness, who really brought it back into the light in that sense. And certainly there's no question about the very pivotal and definitive role that Imam Sultan Muhammad Shah played in our history. But the changes we see in the community under him did not come out of nowhere. And mm-hmm. I think one of the big questions, and something that really struck me as an interesting puzzle as I began researching Ismaili history, was that how do we explain this sort of gap of going from this period of almost complete obscurity to the very large public profile that Imam Sultan Muhammad Shah had? And so I think one of the major agenda items for Ismaili history at this time is explaining that transition in more depth. And Imam Hasan Ali Shah was a very pivotal figure in that transition. So the book really provides us a great deal of insight into what I would call the beginning of the modern period of Nizari Ismaili history.
Interesting.
And it really shows some of the transformations that had occurred within the institution of the imamate within those preceding centuries. And one of the things we see over and over again that comes up in this book is the way that this imam in particular, and of course the imams before him, were received as spiritual authorities outside of the Ismaili community, more broadly within the territory of Iran and Afghanistan, Central Asia, India, through all the areas that he traveled. We see communities, individuals, groups who are respecting him as a Sayyid, as a descendant of the Prophet, as a holy figure,
right,
as a saint even, but not people who would formally consider themselves to be Ismailis mm-hmm. in a strict sense. And I think this is one of the things that is very important for us for understanding this historical transition, where we see more broadly in the Muslim world after the Mongol conquest, there is a sort of decentralization mm-hmm. of authority that takes place. And in the absence of the caliph, of the more centralized institutions, it is really the Sayyids, the Sufi sheikhs, the holy men, people like the imams, who take on this position of religious authority at a more local level. And earlier scholars have talked about this phenomena of the sort of more Sufi-like shape that the community, that the imamate takes after the Mongol conquests, and have considered it to be more of a practice of taqiyya, of a sort of a way of,
right,
of disguising their religious affiliation, mm-hmm, of trying to protect their religious identity. And one of the things I've argued here in writing about this book is that I think we need to reevaluate this, that this is actually a much more deeply rooted, a much more organic transformation that's occurring within the imamate. And we see it particularly in the case of Imam Hassan Ali Shah, where it was publicly known to everyone at that time that he was the imam. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's spoken about openly in the sources from this period. He speaks of it openly in his book. But at the same time, there are many different groups he comes into contact with, again, who do not necessarily recognize him as the imam, but who respect his position, again, as a descendant of the prophet, as a sort of holy person, someone who has this very close connection with God. And so all these sort of anecdotes that come out throughout the course of the book is one of the things I found the most interesting. I think something that really illustrates the very transformed nature of the imamate under him. Mm-hmm. And that I think really explains how the imamate in the 18th and 19th century was able to obtain this more public profile that reached its fruition under Imam Sultan Muhammad Shah.
Yeah, that's interesting. So were there any particular stories specifically from the imam you can recall that would be very interesting for the community to hear about?
Well, you know, there's a lot of very interesting anecdotes that emerge from this book. And I should maybe mention something about the context here. The imam earlier in his life had been appointed by the Qajar ruler of Persia as governor of Kerman province, and located in southeastern Iran. And he had served in that position for about 2 years. It's a rather long story, but eventually there's a series of events that occur that lead to a falling out between him and the government of Iran. And then later he is dismissed from his post as governor, and he perceives that there is a plot moving against him at court. Mm. So he decides, rather than surrendering himself, that it would be more wise to actually take up a defensive position within his castle there in Kerman. And this leads to the beginning of a revolt against the government of Iran that lasts for about a year, at the conclusion of which he is forced to, as you know, migrate from Persia to India. And throughout the course of this revolt, there are many stories where he is seeking help, assistance from local notables, local landlords, people who had clearly a very long-standing family relationship with him. Mm-hmm. There's one case where he is on the run from the royal troops, and he comes to a castle of a local ruler there and is asking for his help. And there's actually a text of the letter there in which the lord of the castle writes to him and talks about how much he respects his Sayyid ancestry, how much the very long-standing ties between their families. And this letter in particular, I think, gives a lot of sort of example of the way that the authority and the standing of the Nizari imams had become very deeply embedded within the social landscape of Iran, and particularly in these border areas in Kerman, Balochistan, the Sindh area in neighboring India, where much of the imam's travels over that period take place. And it's an area where historically the government of Persia had not exercised a great deal of central control. These were sort of kind of a Wild West area where there's not a great deal of centralized government. And it's exactly in these type of areas where people like the imams are able to exercise a degree of authority based on their Sayyid ancestry. Mm. And where there's a very long tradition of Sayyids being able to mediate disputes between different groups, essentially because they're seen as this sort of neutral outsider, again, because they're not necessarily representing a local tribal group, but because they have this ancestry traced back to the Prophet Muhammad. And so we see the imam playing this role over and over again, where he is either at first trying to mediate on behalf of the government of Persia and local elements of society, later between the British government, the British government in India, and over again trying to mediate disputes between people, trying to find ways to to resolve conflicts without resorting to bloodshed. And this is something he comes to again and again in the book. And it's something he very much puts out there as his own role, something that he can perform, again, as a Sayyid, as someone who has this respected genealogy of helping to mediate disputes. So we see a lot of examples in this in the book. And there are other examples that come up in other sources that talk about this period as well that really highlight his role. So again, really illustrating the sort of broader role of the imamate beyond his more strictly defined role as Ismaili imam.